Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from UR subscribers
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Art museums in New Hampshire are exploring new identities and new ways to connect with the public. With so many other choices competing for people's eyeballs and their time, museums know that sticking with the status quo is just not an option. And so these institutions have been stretching themselves, bringing art outdoors, sponsoring pop-up art, responding to social concerns, offering virtual tours, and many other approaches aimed at engaging audiences new and old. But how to do all this on limited budgets and while staying true to a mission? Today in The Exchange, we find out with three arts leaders, and let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Alan Chong, director of the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester, celebrating its 100th birthday this year. And happy birthday, Alan. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm less than 100.
Also with us, John Stomberg, director of the Hood Museum of Art. He's also a curator there. The Hood just reopened in January after 2 years of rebuilding and renovation. And John, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Matt Wyatt, co-chair, co-founder of the Rochester Museum of Fine Arts. It's a community arts initiative founded 7 years ago and based in the Rochester Community Center and Rochester Public Library. And Matt, a big welcome back. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much.
Well, all of you, and I'm going to start with you, Alan. What's the environment like for an art museum these days?
Well, in a certain way, art museums are thriving. The overall visitorship is exciting. It's on the rise. A lot of museums are building or expanding, undertaking new initiatives. We congratulate the Hood Museum for a fabulous new building. So generally, America is fascinated with art. It's fascinated with street art, with performance art, with things in the community. But the traditional bricks and mortar museums are also doing very well. The challenge for smaller towns and smaller areas like New Hampshire, or Manchester, or Portsmouth, whatever, is to find our niche and to do it as best we can. And that's a particular challenge because we're outside the major urban areas of the country.
So that's really interesting. So sort of globally, all art museums are doing pretty well, you're saying, Alan.
Yeah, I'm looking at the numbers and the statistics. We're doing very well. People are interested in the museums. The major museums of the country are experiencing surges in visitorship. It's not completely even, but it's doing very well. How we tap into that here in New Hampshire is more of a challenge. You know, we have certain demographic constrictions. We are a smaller, partly rural state. We face our own social problems with newcomers and people who are, spending more time at home. And how we reach those people, newcomers and longtime residents alike, is not clear. And so we're in an experimental mode at the moment.
Well, that's really interesting. And I'd love to ask you more about that because I'm surprised to hear that answer. You know, I thought you were going to say everybody's on Facebook all the time and they're not bothering to come to the museum. How do you see it, John?
Well, I agree with Alan. One of the things that's really helping actually is the digital revolution. I have yet to meet a person who said, oh, I saw the Mona Lisa online. I don't need to go to Paris. And so it actually helps. And so this great communications tool, the internet, has allowed us to reach into households that we wouldn't otherwise be reaching. And that has led actually to people coming in.
That's really interesting.
And also to Alan's point about the rural situation here in New Hampshire, one of the things that we have have to get around is this idea that success is measured by numbers, the numbers of people crossing your threshold. For us in New Hampshire, success is measured by actually having a deep impact on people's lives. So whereas the Metropolitan Museum in New York might have 10,000 people a day, the Hood will be happy to have a deep impact on 10,000 people's lives over a year.
That's really interesting, and I was going to ask all of you a little bit later, so you're going there. So how do you measure success? Is it just the people who cross your threshold? Sounds like no.
No, we actually measure success anecdotally, and we're comfortable with that because numbers don't really work that well in arts institutions. And so anecdotes, long version responses to surveys are really quite helpful. And so even our kindergarten through 12th grade visits, those are multiple visits, not one-offs. All of our college students come multiple times, and we see a great repeat visitorship amongst our community visitors who tell us that that's what it's like. And for us, anyhow, because we're free and open to the public all the time, people can stop in and spend 20 minutes, stop by on your way to get your dry cleaning and see something for 20 minutes. And you don't have to, quote-unquote, do the museum and go make the big three-hour trek.
Well, I remember when I lived in D.C., the museums were free, and I would do just that. You know, I had an afternoon off, so I would go for an hour, and no harm, no foul. I didn't have to dedicate a whole day to it. How would you answer that first question, Matt? What's the environment like for an art museum these days?
Well, for us, it's very different. You know, the way that we measure success is anecdotally as well, but it's how many kids are in basketball jerseys are wandering our halls picking out their favorite piece, because we are located in a community center and we share space with the Health and Human Resources and the alternative high school and the recreation department. So we have all different types of people that would never otherwise be seeking out fine art, wandering around and picking out their favorite pieces and seeing things that they may not have thought to see that day.
And just describe for our listeners, Matt, how your Museum of Fine Arts isn't really like the Courier or the Hood. It's not in an institution that you have to go to.
Yeah, well, I was joking this morning that I'm sort of the ragamuffin of the group, and I really am. It's definitely non-conventional. We are a community arts initiative in the community center and in the public library, and what we're dedicated to is making fine art, exceptional fine art, accessible to all. And our main audience is a lot of people that wouldn't necessarily be able to afford to even travel to Manchester to the Courier to see fine art. So our mission is to try to attract the best art that we can to our community and help with this revitalization that we're going through in Rochester.
Well, I love the image of kids in basketball jerseys because, you know, they're waiting for the court to empty out so their team can go in. What are they going to do while they're waiting?
Yeah, they look at fine art, which is a great advantage that we have in Rochester at our community center.
A little bit more from all of you, please, and John, you first, on the impact of digital media. You said that back in 1991, we thought we'd all be replaced, we meaning art museums. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the early 90s, when the first impact of the web came out, we began to worry that people would feel satisfied. Oh, I don't need to come to see your art show. I can see all of those pictures online. But by the mid-90s, and certainly by the studies that came out in the late 90s, it was proved that most people use those as teasers and really did want to come in for the actual experience. And what's happened for us, I think, in all museums now is that there's a recognition that the digital experience lacks something authentic. And so people are coming to our museums to connect with something true and real and sort of on a human scale that they lose through the digital revolution. So the more time people spend on their devices, they're building up a pent-up desire to have something authentic like coming to a museum. So it's actually increased the demand for all of the things that we do.
I think it's certainly increased familiarity with art and culture generally. And there's a very happy democratization of knowledge of art history. You can look up every obscure artist online. You can get horrifyingly my dissertation online, you know, immediately. And you can do a lot of research.
20 years ago, we were predicting the demise of the art book, that no one would want to publish art books anymore. And in fact, strangely enough, the net has spurred a resurgence of art books. You know, there's still something wonderful about the tactile nature of an image and word next to each other in an art book, whether it's a coffee table book or a readable book. Indie bookstores are experiencing, at least from my understanding, a small surge, which I think goes hand in hand. The availability of imagery online has spurred museum visits. I couldn't agree with that more. People want to see the real thing. And the familiarity that comes with digital contact actually drives people to see the real thing, whether it's the Mona Lisa, but maybe it's something else. And I think it's a very happy relationship. People see the net as a tool. And increasingly, museum websites are becoming much less important because the conglomerators, the net services, Google Images, are much more important than our own websites. And in fact, we're wondering whether we need to reduce and really produce a skeletal website that will help other people find things through other search engines.
Do you provide virtual tours of the Courier on your website?
We did. We found that they were not particularly popular. They're expensive to produce. The uptake was very low. People like searching on Google. If you type Monet Courier Museum, you get our beautiful painting by Monet on Google Images. And that's better than coming to our website, I think.
What do you think, John? Do you provide virtual tours at the Hood?
We have tried variations on that and also haven't had as much success. What we find is that the web works best as an enticement to come in. One of the things that we do regularly is live tours. We have an education staff, and our curators and myself all give tours. And those have actually been very popular. People want to connect. You know, we have this Friday night program, 6 o'clock, and you can come and have a tour with our curators or myself. And that's the kind of thing that people really want to do, because any other day you can spend at home in your living room on your computer. But this is a moment to connect with other people, to stand in front of something. And when you feel, wow, you can share that with somebody. You can have that conversation. Do you see that flower? Look how amazing that is. You need to share that with somebody. So coming into a space and being in the space with people in art and having that experience is so much more gratifying. And I think people are catching on to that.
Let me invite our listeners to join us, and then a lot more questions. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at New Hampshire art museums, branching out, experimenting, exploring new ways to stay relevant and draw visitors. We're sitting down with the heads of three Granite State art institutions and asking what it's like for art museums these days, what they're excited about, what they worry about. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Matt, what do you worry about in terms of keeping this enterprise going in Rochester?
What I worry about the most is, like I said, we're in a revitalization mode in our downtown especially. And what I worry about is how we can stay relevant in that process. In a lot of the other cities in our area, like Portsmouth, 40 years ago, nobody wanted to go to Portsmouth at all. It was a place that you rolled up your windows when you got to the stoplight. Now everybody's going there. It's so expensive, I can hardly afford to enter. And what we want is a seat at the table. We want to make sure that the arts are involved in this process and that we're headed in the right direction. We want to be involved in the master planning of our downtown and to make sure that arts and culture have a voice.
What does that mean, stay relevant?
You want to make sure that you're invited. You want to make sure that we're talking about things like public art, murals, sculptures. When you're talking about changing the visual landscape of a downtown and you don't have anybody from the arts at the table, I think that's a problem.
Has that happened?
Oh, certainly. Certainly, yeah. Maybe not after today.
Because downtown Concord, 2, 3, 4 years ago, completely sort of blew up and revamped its main street to make it more pedestrian friendly.
It's beautiful.
And there's lots of public art.
That's right.
And I have to say, it's quite enjoyable to just walk downtown. I see tourists taking pictures. I see people taking selfies, you know, of themselves in front of the statue and so forth. Go ahead, Alan. What do you worry about?
Well, I think the question needs to be flipped. Because although politicians and financial people may not fully appreciate it, culture is an important driver of economic success, of the livability of a city, of basic economics. So when we ask to be at the table and to have a voice, we also need to tell our politicians and our city managers and our civic leaders that culture drives the life of a city. It contributes to the livability, it contributes to its economy. The Concord is a great example. It depends, its revitalization depends not only on the public art, but the Capital Arts Center. You have to look at art and culture broadly. And I think statistics and economic surveys have shown that culture is really an important part in drawing new people to a city, enlivening the life of a downtown, in making sure that these things are exciting and relevant. So I think we need to be more confident that our role as museums and cultural institutions writ large is really very important. I mean, we play an important role already, and people just need to wake up and pay attention to it.
So do you feel like you have not had a big enough seat at the table in terms of economic development in the Manchester area? Or not just economic development, but revitalization that Matt talks about?
Well, you know, one of the problems with New Hampshire, and I come here as a recent resident, is that there's a lack of central planning. So whether
everything city by city, town by town,
there's a lot of laissez-faire generally, and it's charming, it's really nice, but there's a certain lack of coordinating of cultural institutions, of historic preservation, which is very weak in our region. And so we are constantly advocating for all of these things. Sometimes people listen to us and sometimes, you know, they don't. And when you look at the New Hampshire landscape, there are actually very few art museums per capita compared to almost any other state in the area, even compared to Vermont or Massachusetts. So I must say, when I hear new arts organizations being founded and startups, you know, taking hold in certain areas, I'm so encouraged that this situation is beginning to change, because otherwise it's really the Hood and the Curry Museum and we're it. And that's not a very good situation.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that New Hampshire has fewer art museums per capita than even other similar states like Vermont, which has an even smaller population than New Hampshire.
Correct.
What do you worry about, John?
I worry about, well, frankly, the role of the museum in the world generally, because I think that it's overlooked how great an impact we can actually have in the lives of people generally. And so I worry that people think of us as a place where pretty things are held rather than a place where lives are changed, because every day I think we can encourage people to pull themselves out of their own world and to examine a larger set of circumstances. And our goal at our museums are usually not just to teach history of art, but to actually impact people's lives in a positive way so that they can pull themselves to a point where there's greater world understanding. And I know that sounds hairy-fairy, but I'm dead serious that empathy is a key to understanding art. You look at a work of art and you think, what was that person doing? Why were they doing it? So you get yourself out of yourself and you think about other people. And if we can do that on a regular basis, then we're succeeding in actually helping change the world. So what I worry about is that museums get ostracized into being thought of as decorative extras rather than a hardworking institution that's actually propelling society forward.
I'm going to ask you more about that after a short break. That's really interesting, the idea of art museums helping us connect with other people, helping us understand other people and where they're coming from. So I'll jump on you on that, John, after a short break. And of course, want to hear from you too, Alan and Matt. And we'll start taking your calls and emails. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More on how art museums here in New Hampshire are remaking themselves, expanding their roles. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Deb Turner, NHPR's Vice President for Development. Thanks if you contributed during the recent fundraising campaign on NHPR. Thousands of listeners generously gave in support of credible, accurate news coverage. Your support is critical in order for NHPR to thrive with independence and stability. If you didn't have a chance to contribute, there's still time to join us. Make a simple gift of support. Keep NHPR strong for you and future generations. Go to nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire art museums exploring new identities and new roles for themselves. We're finding out more from three Granite State leaders in this field, and let's hear from you. Do you visit art museums or avoid them? If so, what would bring you in? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Matt Wyatt, co-founder and co-chair of the Rochester Museum of Fine Arts, a community arts initiative. Also with us, John Stomberg, director of the Hood Museum of Art in Hanover, and Alan Chong, director of the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, and I really do want to hear from people, John, I do want to pick up on something you said before the break that was really interesting. You said your concern or your worry is that people view museums as just places where pretty things are hung. You said, no, no, it's about connecting with the other person. It's about seeking out what the person who created this art might be about, creating empathy with them. How do you do that on a practical level?
We try and make it so that going to a museum is an experience and it's an engagement and it's not a place where you turn off but rather turn on and you open up to new ideas. But also, I mean, our secret sauce, of course, is that we hire educators. Educators are trained differently than art historians. And museums were predicated on art history, which is a lot about looking for similarity and difference. Educators are about communicating, and so we hire people who are trained in education to reach out. And my first job actually was at the Courier in the education department. So this is – I come by this honestly because the education department feels that opening lines of communication with visitors is absolutely key. It can be textual. It can be the way we hang things. It can be special programs for special groups of people. But ultimately, at this point in the world, I think that art museums have an opportunity to show that, yes, there are differences, and those differences are wonderful between cultures, but the similarities far outweigh the differences, and that we are all part of the same world. And let's celebrate those fantastic differences, but let's not neglect the fact that humans across time and across geography have shared more than they have had differences.
So again, on a very practical level, do you have audio tours that explain to people, hey, look at this, look at this. Maybe you didn't notice this. Do you have panels next to the art that give the viewer some depth of understanding?
Yes. As a practical matter, we don't do audio tours because we change too much.
Oh, that's interesting.
We only have 16 galleries and we have 70,000 objects. So we're changing our galleries every 3 months. So to produce a whole audio tour, it would go out of use far too fast. So we rely on text and guides. All of our guides are trained, the people in the galleries are trained to have a conversation with visitors. So they can certainly help out with safety and security, but they're also there to help out with the experience.
That's interesting. So I want to hear from you, Matt, and you too. Alan, Matt, you first. So I love what John said about it isn't just hanging attractive things. It's connecting with the artist and connecting with the other person sort of behind that picture that you're looking at?
Well, we have a small permanent collection that we hang in our spaces, and every piece is actually numbered. So we do have the panel next to each piece that explains the basic information. But what we've done is taken it a step further, and we've developed an app that people can scan a QR code with their smartphone and essentially enter in the number of whatever piece they're standing in front of, and not just get the name of the artist and the title and the medium, but in addition to that information, they also see the artist biography and the artist statement. And
That's really
cool. And they can really dive into what that artist was thinking or what else they were working on, or also just that artist contact information, because we're also about building up the artists that are a part of our collection and connecting those people together.
So your artists are, you know, living, breathing people in the Rochester area.
Yeah, we've had plenty of them from all over the country, really. Like I said, we're trying to draw from all different markets and connect those people. And we do have temporary galleries that we do sell work out of. We do not retain a commission. So whatever artist is selling with us retains 100% of the sales. And like I said, it's all just about connecting those people together. So if somebody's interested in purchasing a piece, we want to connect them with that artist directly so they can see what they have to offer.
Well, it's very interesting. So I'm a big fan myself of the audio tours because it helps me understand. But I hear what you're saying, John. Your collections change so much, you couldn't possibly do that. But Matt seems to be employing, you know, people's smartphones, and just kind of, even if things change a lot, you can look it up.
Well,
so
these devices have been used in various ways. Some people are very happy with an audio tour. They're expensive to produce. The uptake is very small. We actually abandoned one recently.
Really?
Both in Singapore, my previous museum, and in the Courier. So we started and then stopped. We've done apps before. The point is not the method of delivery or communication. Those are tools and devices. The point, going back to what John's saying, is what we want to communicate.
The content.
Do we want to understand the producer of a work, the maker of a work of art? What we've also begun to privilege, and this is something that we know all over the world, is that audience reaction is as important as artistic intent. So it's a two-way street. And what we've begun to do, I think many of us, is to look at audience reaction, have conversations with people, that there's no right or wrong response, no right or wrong conversation or dialogue. And great works of art stimulate feelings in the audience that can be very profound and very meaningful. And as we've moved into social work, into community engagement, for example, with Alzheimer's patients, with sufferers of the opioid crisis, which is a big problem in New Hampshire and Manchester, we find that art is immensely therapeutic. You know, people can project their feelings, their problems, their emotions, their issues onto what they see, whether it's a realistic work of art, whether it's an image of a family, or whether it's something completely abstract that generates those kinds of issues that can't be described easily. And I think this is really an important role for museums to play in using its collection and its exhibitions to help people understand themselves, not just a maker from the past, but actually understand what's happening, you know, in their own hearts. And I think that sounds very grand, but I think it's very important to undertake.
Let's go to our audience. Speaking of audience connections, and hear what people think about art museums, their role today, what their role is right now, what they hope it might be in the future. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. David sent us an email from Port Mills, Vermont. He says, two reasons to visit a real museum rather than online: to see the artist's process, e.g. brush strokes on a canvas, and to experience the size of a large work. Totally agree with you there, David. I was lucky enough to see The Water Lilies by Monet recently. Huge, huge, huge. And then you get up close and you see the brushstrokes and you think, wow, Claude Monet did that. And I'm standing right next to it. So that's pretty cool. David also says, to connect with the artist by being in the presence of something the artist touched perhaps 500 years ago. David, thank you so much for that email. Let's go to our callers. And Dan's in Nashua. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Just wanted to express a word of appreciation. I grew up in New Hampshire, and I'm ashamed to say in the 18-odd years I was here before going off to school and then coming back, I never once visited a New Hampshire art museum or any museum that I could remember. But my wife and I now have two little kids, another on the way, and we have been to the Courier, I don't know how many times, we got the family membership for Christmas, and the programming that they're doing, especially for kids and families around the holidays, but throughout the year where our kids are getting their hands dirty on a regular basis, actually making art, has created a situation where the biggest thing our kids want to do on weekends now is go to the museum.
Really? Wow.
And, it's just thrilling to us, and I just want to appreciate what the Courier and other museums in New Hampshire are doing, and also encourage other families out there who are looking for meaningful things to do with their kids to take advantage of these wonderful offerings.
Well, thank you so much, and you made Alan's day, Dan.
Wow.
So thank you for that, for calling in. I'm going to turn to you, Matt. What about reaching out to families and kids and so forth?
Well, like I said, we're in the community center and we're in the library, so we get an audience whether they're coming to see art or not. And one of the benefits of going to those buildings is the fact that there is art in everywhere. So, and I think that making it accessible is important in a market like mine in Rochester, where we are drawing from other surrounding communities that don't necessarily have any art offerings at all, other than maybe small galleries that might, you know, have a smattering of offerings. You know, pillows, jewelry, things like that. You know, we really want to show people up close. You know, art is worth seeing in person, and there's nothing like seeing it in person compared to a phone.
Well, and I did want to ask you about that, because, again, I'm picturing the kids at the rec center, you know, waiting to get on the basketball floor. Some of them might be drawn over to your art, but as you know, a lot of them will just stare at their phones until it's time for them to go out and shoot. So how do you pull them away from their phones and towards your art hanging on the walls?
Well, part of what we've done, like I said before, was try to combine that interest with the art that's on the wall. So we created the app for that purpose, so they could dive a little bit deeper into what we're showing. But yeah, I think that when you are waiting for your game to start, or, you know, and you're roaming around, you know, I think it just sort of happens. And I don't even think that they know necessarily that they're what they're doing. But they're enjoying fine art and they're picking out their favorite pieces, maybe even sketching while they're in the halls. And I don't think any of them really set out to do that or even think about that as an experience when they leave.
Okay, it's very sneaky of you, but.
Yes.
So go ahead, jump in, Alan. And then, John, I want to ask you about the Hood's role as a teaching museum. But go ahead, Alan.
I think, Dan, the caller makes an important point that art is not just about looking or talking. It's about making. And the Courier has, like many museums, has had a traditional art school where people come and learn the process of making, drawing, making ceramics. But for younger people especially, drawing or painting or making clay sculptures in the museum is an important learning process. You're duplicating what you see. You're emulating an earlier artist. And when you draw, even if it's a copy, you begin to understand in a quiet way what a work of art was about and what a creator in the past was thinking about. And it's a quiet and very profound process. And it reminds me that art history in the 19th and early 20th century was actually taught by copying. In the era before photography, people drew. And in fact, my first undergraduate course, we drew copies of what we were talking about in class, which I found, you know, an amazing experience, and we've kind of lost that in the academic world of, you know, theory and, you know, mediation and all that kind of stuff. But I think for families especially, making art in response to what you see in a museum is immensely educational, and I'm really glad the caller and his family have gotten so much out of it.
Well, and I remember when my kids were little, you know, taking them to the Courier, and there are all sorts of kids' programs there. What about teenagers, though? I mean, they're just very difficult to get out to an art museum.
You put your finger on the biggest bugaboo of art museums,
right?
And that is the high school
era.
They are, hard to put it, a difficult nut to crack. You know, intermediate school, these are the perfect areas for repeating tours, for, you know, consistent visits. High school becomes so broken up socially and academically. We've had a certain amount of success, and we're still pushing this area, in dealing with humanities. It's using the art museum through the humanities to bring people into the museum to have a meaningful experience. That's literature, history, social studies, rather than art history, which is not commonly taught in high schools anywhere.
John, the Hood is often described as a teaching museum. Now, I'm used to the concept of a teaching hospital, but I have to admit I hadn't thought about a teaching museum. What does that mean?
Well, we have a staff that's dedicated to helping professors teach with art. And only about a third of those professors who come in and use us, and we're talking about over 50 professors a term, are from art or art-related departments. One of our major users, for example, is the biology department. Another one is, of course, English and that sort of thing. In the biology department, they come to learn close observation skills. The museum is a great place to learn skills associated with creativity that have the knock-on impact of aiding several different topics. For example, if you are going to be a doctor, you need to learn to look closely, and studying art is a great way to learn that. If you are going to be a lawyer, you need to learn how to articulate an argument, sometimes based on visual evidence, very carefully. Working with art and expressing the visual verbally is a very good preparation for that. So Dartmouth has long since put its money behind the idea that experiential learning is what's going to save the liberal arts, and the Hood Museum of Art is the poster child for experiential learning, because you come in, you study an actual object, and you can learn several different topics from that, only one of which is the history of the object itself. So I talk a lot about learning with art and not about art at the Hood.
So biology majors and pre-law majors and all sorts of students at the Hood.
I have to put in a plug here. The Dartmouth program is the premier program of this type in the country, and universities from all over the world have come to study how the Hood uses its collection in all of its academic fields taught at Dartmouth. I think it's a fabulous program.
Let's take another call, and this is Rosemary in Concord. Hi, Rosemary. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Actually, my comments are exactly along with Spain. I'm a retired educator, and I did a master's degree in multiple intelligences at St. Joseph's University in West Hartford, Connecticut. And we were all teachers, high school teachers mainly, but some elementary school teachers. And we had to create lesson plans connecting the teacher in the classroom to the museum. And it was fascinating. So we're not just bringing a group of students into the museum to, you know, do a tour. The teacher actually creates lesson plans that connect to what he or she is teaching in the classroom, and the kids bring the kids in, and then, you know, the teacher is familiar with what's at the museum, you know, which paintings or sculptures, you know, he or she wants the kids to focus in on. And there's a whole lesson that can be created, and it can cover all kinds of subjects. It can cover math, it can cover English, it could cover science. So it's what I would like to see is that connection between the teacher in the classroom and the museum, and I think it has tremendous potential.
Well, Rosemary, I appreciate the call, and I want to hear from everybody on this, but you first, Matt. Now, you guys are relatively new. You just founded 7 years ago. I wonder what connections you are making or would like to make with schools in the Rochester area.
Well, one of my favorite things is when the schools come into as a field trip to see the art. You know, it's like I said, it's totally accessible, so they can really come anytime with their families. But I think it's especially important when they come with an educator that can slow them down and walk piece by piece and really explain what they're looking at through the use of our app or any of our wording on the walls. I love, one of my favorite things is getting the sketches in the mail, because often they'll have them with materials, with supplies, picking out not only their favorite pieces, but diving in and reproducing them in some cases and sending them to me. So someday I'd like to do an exhibit just of the illustrations that I receive in
the
mail.
Well, I was just thinking that. Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. How do you think young people approach what you are presenting? Again, given that this is a generation that has grown up with, you know, a screen always presenting something all the time.
Yeah, it's tough to compete with what the web offers, especially on smartphones. I mean, we do live in a culture where people are just constantly swiping and not really paying attention or just reading the headline before reading the article. And I think visually, the impact, you know, is far more important than sitting on your phone. So coming in and seeing things, coming in on a field trip with your teacher, enjoying the work in person, there's nothing else like it.
All right, well, I'll ask both of you about that as well, sort of outreach to schools, using art as an educational vehicle. Thank you so much for the call, Rosemary. We'll take more of your calls after a short break. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. More on New Hampshire's art museums in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, privacy online and the track record of those companies that promise to deliver it. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, New Hampshire Art Museums. We're talking with three Granite State leaders in this field about new roles, new challenges, new opportunities to connect with the public. If you are not a regular museum goer, what would convince you otherwise? If you go to art museums often, why? What draws you? Let us know. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And Alan and John and Matt, just before the break, we heard from Rosemary, who really was advocating for connections between schools and art museums. And Matt talked about his work doing that. But Alan, I wonder what you guys are up to at the Courier.
I think Rosemary raises a very important point, and that is curriculum development in coordination with schools. And I'll be perfectly honest, this is something we have not been able to do effectively on the high school level. We would love to work with public high schools in our region to develop exactly as she described, a curriculum that focuses on aspects of the museum collection or, you know, aspects having to do with what we show in exhibitions and that sort of thing. It requires a lot of work. It requires a curriculum specialist. It requires us as a museum to be facilitators and helping this, and it requires the public schools to be participating in a meaningful way. And we're not there yet. We're still working on it. And it probably requires more resources on both sides, on both the museum and on the school side. And this is something that we really haven't been able to raise enough funds for. And
this is, if I had unlimited dollars, this would
exactly,
be a priority.
Exactly. But it's very important because I think for a lot of people in high school, the museum can be a meaningful experience that relates to what they're studying in the classroom and beyond. And I have to say we haven't cracked that problem.
Yeah, well, as John so eloquently described earlier, you know, he uses the items in the hood to help Dartmouth students connect with their studies, whether it's law, biology, or art. What about the Hanover community, though, John? You know, middle school, high school, elementary school.
Yeah, happily, our education staff is divided evenly in half. We have two full-time educators who work with the college students and two full-time educators who work with the community.
Oh, you're making Alan jealous here. Yeah.
So I just meant that we have equal emphasis in both community and the college. And that has been really important to us. We do work with teachers on developing curriculum. We are helping out after the budget cuts of the late 90s and the aughts, art programs from Massachusetts to Canada, and either way, west and east, have been cut. So the hood provides art programming for schools from the Canadian border down to Massachusetts. We kind of overlap then with the Manchester programs that are going on at the Courier. And these are, we try and focus on an approach that I first learned at the Courier, which is field work rather than field trips. So these are multiple visits. So it's not a one-off and a walking through, but actually you're continuing the work that you did in the classroom in the museum, and then that again continues back at the classroom. So it has a lasting, multiple impact. And working on the other thing that we've been trying to do is we now have educators on all of our exhibition committees so that when we choose the shows that we're going to do, we have an educator saying, oh, this would be great for a high school class. And one of the areas of specialty for the hood has really been socially engaged and political shows, and those have a great deal of traction in high school where identity is a huge issue. And so if we're dealing with politics and identity and social issues, those tend to fire the imagination of teenagers.
I see. So give us a little bit more on that. I think I know what you're talking about, but how you use your art museum as a way to connect with some of these very hot social issues that teenagers are interested in. You're right.
Yeah, so we have a show up right now. This is called Consent, and it looks at how contemporary photographers deal with the issue of two people consenting. And officially, it looks at the relationship between the photographer and the subject. Think of the verbs of photography. We take a photograph. We shoot a photograph. This is aggressive language. But it also has a direct parallel in the way young people relate to one another in terms of consent for physical touching and being part of one another's life and that sort of thing. So we've taken the art and made the parallel to real life, and that has had a lot of connections. And there's no teenager out there right now who's not thinking about consent on some level.
Well, Bruce in Lebanon wrote in. He says, John Stomberg's fresh view of the purpose of the Hood Museum is resonating with Dartmouth students, alumni, and the citizens of the Upper Valley. There is plenty of history in art, Bruce says, but there is also current relevance, just what you're talking about, John. Bruce says, my Dartmouth class of 1967 is particularly delighted to have expanded opportunities for student curators to become involved in the expanded New Hood. So, Bruce, thank you for that note. Since Alan mentioned money, let's talk a little bit about that. And to you first, Matt, where do you guys get your money? Now, again, you're all volunteer. You're in the community centers, so you don't have to pay rent or heat or light, but you must need a little money to, you know, keep things going.
Yeah, well, we have a great model, like I said, so we don't require a ton of money because we are utilizing public spaces that are already funded, already in operation, and will be long after, too.
Somebody else is paying the property taxes.
Yeah, thank God, including me. But what we do have is a friends program. So from the $25 level all the way up to $1,000 level, people can become a friend of the museum and receive various benefits in shops and restaurants downtown.
Oh, okay.
And this is how we achieve some of these projects, like our public art project that we're doing in the spring, where we've commissioned an artist to basically install four large metal sculptures around the common. You know, this is where that type of money, what we're raising money for, is these small projects. Last year, we did a project where we had a muralist cover up some of the boarded up windows in some of the alleyways and different streets downtown. Talking about that visual landscape impact, and you know, it's all about trying to get funds for artists to come and help enhance the downtown area.
So that's the connection you talked about earlier, where you said, look, we want to be at the table as Rochester looks at revitalization. So there you are, making it a little bit more pretty, if I could put it that way, a little more attractive, a little more interesting. And in return, local businesses have said, yeah, sure, we'll give a little discount for people who support your arts organization.
That's right.
the synergy there.
That's right.
Really interesting. So my image of the Hood, John, you're going to correct me if I'm wrong, is that you get all your money from Dartmouth.
Well, we get a lot of money from Dartmouth. We also get a lot of money from alums. But we are active in grant writing. We do have that model, which is a very different model, which comes with strings attached. In other words, most museums, you have a board of trustees and a director who really steer the museum. We are part of a college, so I have a boss. Who has a boss? Who has a boss? You know, so I'm part of a much
bigger bureaucratic.
We all have bosses.
Oh no, I think Alan gets to do anything he wants to do.
It's always a boss.
But yes, we are strongly funded by endowment that is museum specific and the college and annual gifts. About one third, one third, one third for our funding.
How about you, Alan?
We're an independent museum with an independent board. Quite different, I think, from both of your models. We have a generous endowment which provides most of our funding, but we depend on revenue streams on rentals, on our cafe and shop, with our admissions, which we are not free, which is...
You're free, right?
Yes. Yeah.
John's
okay,
free. And so we need to have all of those revenue streams coming together. We get money from grants and a lot of very generous donors on an annual basis. So it's a diversified stream, but heavily dependent on our endowment, which is a good thing because you want to have that security for, you know, our next 100 years. And I think that's very important. But we are, in a sense, the masters of our own fate. We have good relationships with the city. We have the land that we sit on, so we're not dependent on government for any of those things. We don't pay property tax because we're a nonprofit. But, you know, it also means that when we want to do something new, we've got to look for those resources and generate interest in and of itself. And I think that's a particular problem at this at this juncture with the demographic shift happening in southern New Hampshire, with a lot of new industry, a lot of new people moving here, and how we tap into that becomes very important for our future financial stability.
Well, it's interesting. And Manchester, as you well know, I'm sure, Alan, has the new army, the Regenerative Tissue Institute, supposedly lots of young, smart, educated, well-paid people will be coming to the city. But how do you make that step to reach out to them?
Yeah, that's a tough one, because they may not be traditional museum goers. They may not have the time. They may not have the interest with a lot of other things. What we've experimented with are events, special events that are geared for people who are new to New Hampshire. We have a free block party in the summer. It's going to be our third year this July, which is lots of fun. The museum's open to the public. Lots of food and music and activities. We run a couple of dance parties with exciting different things, a Renaissance mass ball, a contemporary dance party. So we've experimented with diversifying our events. So you can come and see the art, but you can also come and have a good time. And so we've expanded, I think, our demographic through these schemes.
Becoming like an attractive events venue. And exactly. People don't mind maybe paying a little bit more for that versus the admissions fee you're becoming
a
member.
What really happens is that our standard admission metrics has begun to change. People don't necessarily come once a month and then become members and then become supporters of the museum. People might want to just come to events and special happenings at the museum. That might be the model where we have to look at.
John, did you want to jump in real quick?
I just wanted to say that I think this is true. One of the changes that we see in younger audiences especially is interactivity. People want to come in and not passively walk through galleries, but they want to do things. They want to participate. They want to get involved somehow. And so we are following in their footsteps and trying to come up with things. Unfortunately, it's not a natural, you get a PhD in art history. We're very excited to go see another art history lecture, but not everybody feels that way. So maybe some people want to do something other than sit and listen to an art history lecture.
Yeah.
Go figure. No. I know. I can't believe it.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, is there a stereotype of the person who will visit an art museum or go see some of the art that you have exhibited, Matt? I mean, is it typically the well-educated, well-heeled person, John?
It's really changing, I think. I mean, it really is. I think that museums were once the bastion of the well-heeled and the well-educated, but we have been working, all three of us, you can hear it, very hard to open the doors to everybody and really make it clear that you're welcome here. That's the hardest thing. Even being free, I still have to tell people, really, come inside. And the money isn't the obstacle that it once was. If we're doing fun things, people want to come anyhow. And we did recently throw a party, and it had music and the whole thing, and 1,300 people came. We couldn't believe it. You will never get 1,300 people for an art history lecture. I'm just guessing.
Maybe.
Well, yes, if Alan was speaking, of course.
Well, that's kind of what you're all about, Matt, right? I mean, reaching new audiences.
Yeah, well, we deal with stereotypes.
Not the traditional, yeah.
Yeah, we deal with stereotypes all the time, except it's the opposite. It's not the affluent. It's the people that are coming into that building. And when 7 years ago, when we decided to start in the community center, a lot of people warned me and said, why would you want to be in that building? Do you know the type of people that are going into
really,
that building?
Really? People said that to you?
Well, because there's the Department of Health and Human Resources. There's the alternative high school. There's all these different groups. There's the food pantry. And
that's so snobby.
But yeah, it is. And my answer to that is, well, that's exactly where I want to be. Those are exactly the people that I want to see this art. So I think, it doesn't matter who you are or what background you have or what level of education that you've received. If you want to come and enjoy something and it's accessible and it's free, then, spend the day with us in Rochester.
Let's take another call. This is Paula in Windsor, Vermont. Hi, Paula. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Wonderful show, Ms. Tenoy, as always. I wanted to make sure that the gentleman from Hood Museum in Hanover has talked about the wonderful Epic of American Civilization by one of the top three 20th century muralists, Orozco. As a teacher, I would bring my high schoolers armed with pencils and paper, and after we went through it, sometimes with a guide, sometimes, unfortunately, it was just me, and they would do a sketch. You'd go back to the classroom, and everybody would take a meat tray and the tail. My husband would bring him a spackling, and they'd recreate one of the images. It's just a world-famous work, and it's here in northern New Hampshire.
Well, Paula, thank you so much, and I have to admit, I didn't know about that.
What Paula says is absolutely true. There's a natural heritage site housed at Dartmouth College in Baker Library. It is the Orozco mural. It is in a complete cycle, the epic of civilization. It is one of the top artworks in the United States, and it is actually in Hanover, New Hampshire, and it is you can go see it at any time.
So it's not in the Hood Museum.
Correct. It is in the Baker Library, and we take care of it.
Well, I got an email from Ben before the show started. He says, I'm the director of the Adrian Duckworth Art Museum in Meriden. Ben says, our museum is a small, seasonal, May to October, contemporary and modern art museum with the dual focus of presenting the life and work of the late Adrian Duckworth, as well as showing contemporary artists in the Upper Valley and beyond. We have a full 2019 schedule, which will include traditional painting, drawing, sculpture, as well as more experimental works. And he says, thanks so much for making New Hampshire Art Museums a focus for your programming today. And Ben, you're welcome. And, you know, I love that he sent that email because anybody can take this. I'm wondering if there's all sorts of little, smaller art museums around the state that, you know, people aren't even aware of. Alan?
Sure. They're here and there. They're scattered around, and some of them are locally run. Some of them affiliated with universities or colleges. They all struggle in their own ways and you know, need a lot of help and support. There's a great deal of community diversity. I mean, historic societies in New Hampshire are probably the most active among these smaller community institutions. And they have art, too, which is really quite wonderful. And, you know, they push the envelope in many ways in working with photographers, with working with local watercolorists when there's a historic connection or a community connection. But there are lots of them around.
So real quick, and I feel badly asking you guys this at the very end, but maybe 15 seconds, convince me to come to Rochester next weekend, Matt, and see what you guys have going on.
Well, as you know, you always have a standing invitation. But I would encourage people to go to our website, rochestermfa.org, and see what we're all about, and come and stop in and check us out sometime.
Okay, so why should I come up to Hanover this weekend, John?
The great thing about the Hood is the entire history of art is on view in 16 galleries, so you can go 6,000 years in 16 galleries.
Wow. Okay. Alan?
We're going to open this weekend Ubiclay, which is a fantastic exhibition of beadwork created by a collective of South African women. So not only does it tap into a traditional glass bead tapestry form, it also addresses Africa, the problems of HIV and female independence, and the economic reality of Africa today. So come and have a look.
Well, all of you, we have links to your various organizations on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. This has been great, guys. Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
A pleasure.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.